I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We live in a time when people will give away or throw away an old book. The artifact we call a book is so common, even mundane. These things seem as ubiquitous as pebbles or blades of grass. They may not be as numerous as the sands of the seashore, but you get my drift. They are plentiful and mostly cheap. Mostly, I would say, pedestrian. Come with me back to a time when books were coveted, rare, and cherished, when bound pages with handwritten text – handwritten, I say, because the printing press, not yet a thing – when these kinds of books were new on the world stage. Human culture was just coming to terms with the possibilities that books offered us. And the appetite behind our hunger for books back then, it was an appetite for knowledge and wisdom and truth and understanding. Whatever a meaningful life had been before the book, now that meaningful life could grow exponentially because the transmission and the preservation of the body of human wisdom finally had a vehicle, a home, a physical embodiment. Trying to imagine the world at such a time really isn't all that easy, I would say, because as I've already indicated, for us, books are just givens. And most books we encounter nowadays certainly don't house much wisdom. Maybe the easiest way to conjure up that era when books were new is through stories of the people who were excited by them, who prepared them, who sold and collected and traded in them. And apparently some of the more dramatic stories about these people take place in Florence, Italy, in a time we now call the Renaissance. I'm pleased to introduce you to Ross King. King is a best-selling author of books on Italian, French, and Canadian art and history. Among his books are Brunelleschi's Dome, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, and Leonardo and the Last Supper. Many other books. He's published two novels, Domino and Ex Libris, a biography of Machiavelli, and I have to mention this, this is kind of fun, a collection of Da Vinci's fables, jokes, and riddles. Today we're going to visit with Ross King about his most recent book. It's titled The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. Ross King, welcome to our program.
Hello, Marcus. Thanks very much. Great to be here.
You know, if getting your hands on written books or documents or manuscripts was challenging in these earlier times, I kind of want you to take us on one of the early hunts for manuscripts. Who exactly was on the prowl, if you can put it that way, and what did they do?
Well, I mean, yes, it's interesting that this was a profession that existed 600 years ago, that of manuscript hunter, someone who specialized in hunting down ancient manuscripts in, for the most part, ancient monastery libraries, because that's where they figured, in most cases rightly, they were going to be able to find these books. Probably one of the most famous, one that some of your listeners might have heard of, was a man named Poggio Bracciolini, who was born around 1380 and did a lot of sleuthing through and sort of Indiana Jones type library archaeology in the first and second decade of the 1400s. He would set off from Florence or from Rome. He worked for the papacy, for the popes at various points in his career. He would set off and go north of the Alps. He would go into Switzerland, Germany, and France, because he reckoned quite rightly that everything that existed in Italy that could have been found already for the most part had been found in the previous couple of generations. And the best hunting grounds were now monastery libraries, the libraries that had been founded some 500, 600, 700 years earlier in, let's say, 800, 900, 1000 AD. Going back and sort of pillaging them, getting access from the abbot to the library and hunting around looking for an ancient manuscript that no one had seen, say, for the past 500, 600, 700 years. And so he made a number of great discoveries. One of the most important ones, I think the one that really thrilled him the most, is when he discovered a whole and complete copy of the ancient Roman writer Quintilian, who lived in the first century AD and who was a famous teacher and rhetorician in Rome. No one had seen his book on the education of an orator, a complete copy, for many centuries, and it was said to be one of the most sought-after books. And Poggio miraculously found one in a Swiss monastery at St. Gallen in present-day Switzerland. And there was widespread celebration in Florence and elsewhere when he returned with it, because they believed that this book had a wisdom in it that would teach them how to live their lives better, how to govern themselves better, how to educate their children better, how to give better speeches, and so forth. And that's what they were looking, that was the purpose of these manuscript hunts, going back into the past to the what they believed had been the greatest society that had ever existed, that of ancient Rome, either the Republic or the Empire, and getting the literature from that period, which would give a kind of template or a blueprint or a playbook for what life could be like in the 1400s.
So what class of society did these manuscript hunters come from? I can only imagine that they were learned people themselves. If someone like Poggio is going to go north of the Alps hunting, he has to kind of have in his mind kind of a bibliography of what was already available in Florence.
That's right. They were, for the most part, they came from, or a number of them, including Poggio, came from humble origins. He was born in a village outside of, not too far outside of Florence, and he came turned up in Florence as an adolescent, really wanting to study. And he studied Greek and Latin. Florence had one of the first great teachers of Greek in the West, a man named Manuel Chrysoloras, who the Florentines enticed away from Constantinople in 1397 to teach Greek to them. Because, of course, very few people in the West understood Greek, or at least they didn't know Greek well enough to read Plato, for example, someone else that the Florentines were eager to discover and begin reading. But Poggio's father was basically a grocer or spice merchant. So Poggio came from fairly humble origins, but was obviously extremely intelligent. And one of the secrets of Florence in the 1400s seems to have been, the more you look at the characters who flourished there, is that talent was recognized no matter where it came from, no matter what sort of humble circumstances the person would have come out of. Knowledge was kind of democratic at that time. I mean, Florence was experimenting with a democracy. You know, out of, say, 40,000 people, 5,000 had the right to vote, adult males who were property owners and weren't in arrears in their taxes had the right to vote. And we can say today that 5,000 out of 40,000 is not very good, but that's a whole lot better than most other cities in Europe. And so likewise, they had a kind of democratic attitude towards knowledge. And in my book, I described the sort of al fresco debate that went on all over Florence in places like the Piazza della Signoria, which many of your listeners will have visited if you've gone to Florence. There were debates under awnings, under roofs, on street corners in the piazza and so forth. And they were so learned that one great scholar, a man named Giannozzo Minetti, one of the greatest scholars of the 1400s, learned to speak Latin like a native, apparently, like an ancient Roman, simply initially by listening to these debates and then joining in and honing the craft. And so it was a city that sort of pulsed with intellectual life that was really exploited by people like Poggio Bracciolini or a man who comes along many decades later, Angelo Ambrogini, who called himself Poliziano after Montepulciano, where he grew up. He was a very poor boy. He had, you know, at the age of 15, he was shuffling around Florence in shoes with his toes poking out and living in the poorest part of Florence. But his talent was recognized, his talent as a translator of Greek and Latin. And so it just seems that the Florentines were great talent spotters and able to recognize brilliance wherever and whenever they saw it.
Well, I am willing to believe that these people came from humble circumstances, many of them. I'm willing to believe that there was a democracy of knowledge, that people had the freedom to come and listen to these public debates. But books were pricey. Manuscripts cost money. And I can only imagine still that the upper classes were the ones who could, you know, foot the bill to acquire these treasured manuscripts.
That's right. You're absolutely right in that. And the other thing they did not have anywhere is libraries, public libraries. There were libraries, of course, like these monastery libraries that I've been talking about, and you might be able to talk your way into it to be able to see what they had in the collection. But for the most part, our, you know, what we think of as the public library did not exist until one was founded in Florence at the Library of San Marco in the 1440s, thanks to Cosimo de' Medici. And so, yes, it was very hard if you were a young scholar, a hopeful scholar from a poor family. Accessing knowledge was very difficult. But once again, the Florentines had a kind of magic recipe, which was that they had a number of figures who were extremely generous with their libraries and their private libraries and made them available. So Florence might not have had a public library, an official public library, but unofficially it did. And that was really thanks to a man named Niccolò Niccoli, who had what was said to be one of the most beautiful private homes in Florence. He was extremely wealthy, or relatively wealthy. His father was a fairly affluent wool merchant. And Niccolò had simply used, he didn't get involved in trade at all, apart from the trade in manuscripts. He spent all of his fortune that he had inherited on assembling a library of books. But the remarkable thing for us, I think, looking back at that time, looking back, let's say, 600 years, is that Niccoli had, I mean, I might ask you how many, the largest private collection of books in Europe, which is what Niccoli had, we might guess, did he have 5,000 books, 10,000 books? But in fact, he had 800 books. That was the sort of sum of knowledge that was available to him, 800 books. And I did some research, and the average primary school in England is supposed to have 1,300 books. So Niccolò Niccoli, the greatest book collector of the 1400s, had less than the average primary school in England. But, you know, his books were obviously high quality. He had a wide range. And crucially, he made them available to friends, but also to young scholars. He would invite people into his home. He would invite people to his home. And then when they came, he would give them a book and tell them, sit and read. And there'd be maybe eight other people sitting reading books. And then after a couple of hours, they would all put their books aside and begin discussing what they'd been reading. So it was a kind of early book group or discussion group that was really fostered by Niccoli. And so there was a capability an ability on the part of people like Poggio Bracciolini to get access to knowledge if you had the right sort of connections and if you had the right sort of brilliance that was recognized by someone like Niccolò Niccoli.
A couple of things I want to ask you. One is, if this Poggio was in any way kind of going out on Indiana Jones-like adventures, what was one of the more adventuresome kinds of exploits that he undertook to acquire? You mentioned one of them, finding the thing in St. Gallen in Switzerland.
Right.
And the other question is, what really was a book back then? I mean, these were expensive and hard to come by, very difficult to manufacture, and taking one in hand, what would a person have had actually in the hand?
Well, yes, what you had probably varied quite widely, because obviously it was a manuscript, because as you said, we're a couple of decades before the advent of the printing press at this point in the first half of the 1400s. And so a book would have been what Poggio could have expected to find in a library was something that was written in ink on parchment by a scribe, probably around 800 or 900 AD. There was a great period of manuscript copying done at that time. There was if you think of what it took for a work from ancient Rome, so from, say, the first century AD, like the Quintilian, to survive to get its way into the hands of Poggio Bracciolini in, say, 1410, it needed to be copied multiple times over the course of the centuries, because the ancient Romans had written on papyrus. They did have parchment, but they didn't appear to have embraced it as a technology. All of their knowledge went onto papyrus scrolls. It was the Christians then who really invented or adopted the parchment codex, what we think of as a book, with parchment, of course, as animal hide, scraped animal hide. The wisdom from one of the scrolls to survive up to 1400, it had to be copied once or twice at least over the course of that, say, 1200, 1300, 1400 years, because the papyrus would perish. It's highly doubtful that someone like Poggio Bracciolini ever came across a copy of something that was written in ancient Rome on papyrus or on parchment, for that matter. What he got instead, so when he's discovering ancient Roman works, ancient Roman literature and philosophy and teaching, he's not discovering the ancient Roman works themselves, which have long ago perished. What he's finding are works written by Christian scribes in the monasteries around 800, 900 AD, for the most part after 800, when they are now copied on parchment by the scribes. And so he discovered quite a number of these with great excitement. And it may well have been that he believed he was actually finding works that were written in the time of the ancient Romans. It's a bit of an open question. He did not know. We know today how old the manuscripts he found were, but sadly, he didn't. He may have thought they were much, much older than they actually were. But you were describing the adventures he had when he discovered Quintilian. He discovered that it was in what he called a dungeon of, speaking metaphorically, a dungeon in the monastery at St. Gallen. It was presumably in some sort of a basement of a tower or the ground floor, very musty, dusty, spiderweb-shrouded a tower in which he said it was almost falling apart, and he tried to borrow it. He always tried to borrow these books, but the monks and the abbots were far too wise. They knew they'd never get them back, and so he would sit down and copy out in his own beautiful handwriting the wisdom of these ones. And quite a number of the works that exist today, or a number of works that exist today, exist only because of the fact that we have Poggio's copies of them, which people decades after then made copies of, but the copies that he found have long since disappeared. And so without him having come upon them, we would no longer have these works, and they would have vanished to history like so much else. But just a quick aside about one other adventure someone had, probably in terms of the number of discoveries he made. The greatest of the manuscript hunters was a man named Giovanni Orispa, who was Sicilian. And because of the fact that he grew up in Sicily, Sicily in southern Italy still had a strong Greek influence, and Greek was spoken there. He could understand Greek. So he went to points east to the Levant, Constantinople, and he came back in the 1420s, came back to Florence, where he knew he would be able to sell these, with 238 manuscripts of Greek tragedies, Greek comedies, Greek science, all of these things. And when he arrived back, he admitted that he had to sell his clothing. He said he had to sell his pairs of pants in order to acquire these because he ran out of funds. And so he had to barter with his clothing with the Greeks in order to get his hands on them, something for which he said, "I feel neither shame nor regret," and nor should he have, because of the fact that, once again, he's someone who helped preserve knowledge by bringing it from somewhere where it may have perished and taking it to somewhere where, in fact, it was cherished and therefore has survived to this day.
Well, the metaphor I'm familiar with is being willing to give the shirt off one's back, not the pants off one's bottom. That's very different.
Yes.
We want to get into the story of a wheeler and dealer in books, the central character in your book, Vespasiano, and we're going to do that after a short break here on Constant Wonder. We'll return to visit more with Ross King about his book, The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Ross King is with us, a prolific author and a scholar of French, Italian, Canadian art and history, and he is very conversant with the story of Florence and the Renaissance there. And we're talking with him about his latest book, The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. Vespasiano, who was he? I called him a wheeler and dealer. Is that too fast and loose?
No, I mean, that's probably quite an accurate description of what he was doing insofar as he did buy and sell manuscripts and produced manuscripts. And he's one of these people who, once again, is from rather humble circumstances. He was a fatherless 11-year-old boy when he went to work. One of the things we have to recognize about Florence is they had what we would describe today as child labor. He started work at 11 in a bookshop. And it's a bit of an open question or a bit of a mystery, really, why he ended up in the bookshop, because of the fact that his father, who died in 1426, Vespasiano was born in 1422, so he was only four when his father perished. We don't know why his father was in the wool trade, and Vespasiano, it would have made sense for him to go work for a wool merchant or someone his father might have known. But instead, he went to work for a bookseller. And it may well be that someone recognized that this little boy is extremely bright and loves books, and therefore he can maybe be trained up to do something in the book trade. But I think no one at that point in 1434, when he went to work, would have recognized the sort of grandeur, the heights that he would have reached over the next few decades as he became known as the king of the world's booksellers. So he was a wheeler and dealer, and he was really the greatest manuscript dealer and manuscript producer in Europe over the course of the 1400s. Certainly one of the greatest in history because of the fact that he produced probably many thousands of manuscripts over the course of his long career, and many, many thousands of others would have passed through his hands as he sold them to both the crowned and the laureled heads of Europe, both very wealthy people who wanted to put together great collections, but also to scholars who wanted to be able to have copies of the books that Vespasiano was producing.
Now, we say that Vespasiano was producing these books. We're so used to a division of labor and specialization. You know, after Henry Ford, we think about the person in charge, but all the laborers doing the grunt work. How would you describe Vespasiano's role in all of this? Was he just the overseer of this? Did he know how to make a book himself? Did he transcribe things the way Poggio did?
He certainly knew how to make a book, but he did not have great handwriting. There were a couple of samples of his writing, and I don't think he ever could have cut it as a scribe. But we have to think of it's maybe a good thing to say he was an overseer or supervisor. Another way of thinking about him is he's a combination of bookseller and publisher. He's someone who is publishing books, even though he's, you know, publishing them singly, producing these manuscripts. But, you know, we have to think of what it was like if you wanted a book back in those times. So if you would go into his bookshop, say in 1440, and say, I want a copy of this Quintilian I've been hearing about. I know how Poggio found a copy of it back in 1416, and I'd love to have a copy and be able to read it. And do you have one? And it might well have been the case that Vespasiano had one in his shop, in which case he would sell it to you. And it probably would have cost, a book like that would have cost probably around 20 ducats. Or 20 florins. Florin and ducats, virtually the same value gold coin. To put that into context, probably the wages of A carpenter in Florence would have been 40 or 50 ducats per year. So a single book, a single work of classic Roman literature would have been 6 months' wages. So as you were pointing out, it was merely the elite in society who were able to purchase books. So if Vespasiano did not have a copy of Quintilian, what he would do is tell you, I don't have it, but I will make one for you. And that's when he would go to work as the manuscript producer, because what he would do would be to get a copy of Quintilian, what's called the exemplar. And this is something he excelled at. He would know, for example, that Cosimo de' Medici had a copy of it because he worked on Cosimo de' Medici's library, or he would know that the Benedictine monastery across the street had a certain manuscript, and he could always find one that he would then hire a scribe or scribes to copy. He had access to all of these collections. He could tap a lot of people and say, look, I need to borrow your copy of Ptolemy or your copy of Aristotle for a month or 6 weeks or something like that to get a copy made. And so that's what he would do. He would hire a scribe. He would get all of the parchment. He would give it to the scribe. He would give the exemplar, the copy text, to the scribe and say, here it is, copy it out. And he had around 40 or 50 scribes who worked with and for him at various points in his career. So he could juggle a lot of balls. He had a lot of balls up in the air as he was doing very large libraries of hundreds and hundreds of copies for people like the Duke of Urbino or people like the Lord of Pizarro, that all of whom wanted hundreds of books to burnish their reputations as great men of learning. And so having then got his copy of the manuscript back from the scribe, he would then give it to someone else, the illuminator, and the illuminator would then take it and decorate it, give flourishes, paint in the capital letters, maybe do some decorations, put in a coat of arms, something like that. And so we would have, at the end of maybe 6 weeks, 12 weeks, perhaps, some works took even longer, some might take as long as 6 months to produce, he would have the book for you, and you would then hand over the price of it. Probably the most expensive one that he produced, he produced a set of The City of God of St. Augustine, which cost, it was a 10-volume edition, so it was a massive set of work, but it was 500 florins, 500 ducats that it cost, which is, you could buy several houses in Florence for that sort of outlay of cash. And so this is the way he operated. He was, a wheeler and dealer and a mover and a shaker who seemed to know everyone. He was on personal terms with Pope Nicholas V, with three generation of the kings of Naples, with three generations of the Medici, with all of the sort of crowned heads of Europe, with people in Hungary, with people in England. So he was extremely well-connected, both in terms of the patrons or the clients that he had, as well as in terms of where books were. I sometimes wonder if he had a kind of photographic memory, because he seemed to know where everything was, where every copy of every book was, and so he could find it and then have it copied and multiplied. I think that's one of the crucial things that he did, was he multiplied wisdom on a modest scale compared to the printing press, of course, but nevertheless, he was diffusing this knowledge all across Europe.
Now, you talked about the democracy of knowledge, and I'm just wondering how much Vespasiano was at the hub of what was essentially a boys' club. Were women involved in this learning, too?
To some extent. Where you would look for it, I mean, certainly there were elite women who were involved, who knew Latin, who studied Latin. But for them, alas, it was always just going to be a kind of hobby that intrigued and fascinated the men. There was a woman, Alessandra de Bardi, who was known as one of the most brilliant scholars and writers of her generation, and also Lorenzo de' Medici's mother, was Lucrezia Tornabuoni. She came from a wealthy banking family, and she married into the Medici. And she, too, was extremely erudite. She knew Latin, and she composed poetry. So at the very, very top level, you found women who wrote poetry and knew Latin, and even in some cases, Greek. But for the most part, women were not educated all that well because of the fact that it was believed that reading books would corrupt them. Reading books like Boccaccio's Decameron would give them immoral thoughts. And so the monks sort of advised parents not to educate their children. Ironically, however, where you found educated women was in the convents, in the monasteries. Nuns often were well educated, but they were, of course, it was safe to educate them, to teach them Latin and to teach them to read, because they were quite literally shut away. It was being a nun was not unlike being in prison. I mean, the conditions inside the convent were better than most prisons, I would think, but you were shut away. If you were a Dominican nun, you had no contact with the outside world except in extremely controlled environments. And to a lesser extent, that went for women as a whole in Florence. The preachers on the pulpits and the piazzas often castigated Florentines for letting women go out without a chaperone. You were to be chaperoned by one or two older women. If you were a young woman, you were not to appear at the window. You're not to stand in your doorway. You were to be essentially neither seen nor heard, because, of course, Florence at that time, like so many other places, was a city in which male honor was felt to rest on the behavior of the female, on the behavior of the wives and the daughters of the men. And so forward thinking, as we can say Florence was in many respects, we also have to appreciate the fact that we're still in the 1400s and there are still some fairly derogatory views about women,
right.
fairly backward views about women.
Right. Well, at the peak of his career, Vespasiano catches wind of developments way up north in a city called Mainz in Germany and a fellow named Gutenberg. How does that go over with Vespasiano?
Not well. There was a bit of a time lag for him. He didn't have to do anything immediately because, as far as we know, the Gutenberg Bible, the 42-line Bible, of which probably about 180 copies were printed, was seen for the first time, or at least the first eyewitness account we have of it comes from someone who later becomes Pope. He becomes Pope Pius II. But he is on a mission from the current pope at that time in 1454. He's going up. Constantinople has fallen to the Ottoman Turks the year before in 1453. And so this man, Aeneas Silvio Piccolomini, is sent to German lands to convince the German princes to arm themselves and let's all go into battle and free Constantinople. Aeneas goes up there and he turns up at Frankfurt and the fair is on. And he sees what he calls a miraculous man at the fair with Bibles, which look like they're copied out by a scribe. But as he says, they're not. And this miraculous man has made some 180 of them. And so it's 1454, almost the middle of the century, the middle of the 1450s, that Gutenberg has perfected it and brought it to a very, very high level of sophistication. But the first printing press in Italy doesn't open for another 10 years. It opens, it was Germans who brought it there in 1464 in Subiaco at a monastery outside of Rome. And a year or two later, it moved into Rome. But really by the late 1460s, there were just a handful of printers south of the Alps in Italy, all of them Germans who'd come. They realized that the greatest market for books was in Italy, because the Italians for the previous 200 years had been the greatest producers and consumers of manuscript. They were the Italians were the people of the book at this time, and the Germans quickly realized there's money to be made if we cross the Alps with our printing presses and set up. And so that's what began happening in the late 1460s, early 1470s. And so Vespasiano had some breathing space. And not until 1476 did anyone begin operating a printing press with any success in Florence. And so that's two decades after Gutenberg produced his Bible, and almost a decade after Gutenberg's death in 1468. And when it comes to town, Vespasiano ignores it. He really disdains it. He says that the printing press, a book from a printing press, would be ashamed to share company with one of his books. And that may well have been true, because his books were deluxe items made on parchment with talented scribes and the best illuminators. And a lot of books that you would buy at that time were somewhat haphazardly produced, and the production values maybe were not all that good. The attention to detail was lacking. Of course, there were some very beautiful books produced at this time, but a lot of them maybe were a kind of ephemera that Vespasiano had absolutely no truck with. And so he ignored it until gradually he was swept away by it. The printing press that began in Florence in 1476 was at a convent, the convent of San Jacopo de Ripoli, and it was operated by nuns. Nuns worked as compositors, as typesetters for it. And so Vespasiano ultimately was put out of business. He closed the doors of his shop and retired to the country in 1480, somewhat embittered by what he saw happening. He didn't just blame the printing press. He blamed the times. He said that there are no great princes left like Cosimo de' Medici or like Federigo da Montefeltro, the Duke of Urbino, who had commissioned so much work from him, what Vespasiano called the greatest library since antiquity. All of this world, this bookish world of manuscripts and libraries, princely libraries, was disappearing at that time. And what was taking its place was the world of the common reader. And Vespasiano did not really cater to that. His books were simply too expensive to produce. The printing price reduced the price of a book by 80%. A printed book cost a fifth of the price of what one of Vespasiano's manuscripts cost. So obviously it brought a huge group of new readers into the marketplace. And San Jacopo de Ripoli, with its book, we have the account books of them, and the account books show that a lot of artisans in Florence, shoemakers and wool workers, dyers, people like this were buying the books, which testifies to the high level of literacy on their part, and also the fact that the books were cheap enough that they could afford to dispose of some of their income on a book. And Vespasiano, that was simply a world that he could not inhabit any longer. And so, as I say, he closed up his shop in 1480 and retired to the country and began writing a book of his own, a number of books of his own. He decided, if I can't publish, I'll become a writer myself.
It's a pleasure to have a chance to speak with Ross King, best-selling author of many books, including his latest, The Bookseller of Florence, the story of the manuscripts that illuminated the Renaissance. We're going to talk more about Vespasiano's frustrated reaction to the printing press when we return to Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're visiting this hour with Ross King. He's author of The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. The main character, Vespasiano da Bisticci, had employed scribes and illuminators to make those wonderful books by hand. This is at the height of the Renaissance in Florence, Italy. And we've learned that he was basically caught off guard by the emergence of this new invention, the printing press. And by the time that printing takes hold in Florence in the late 1470s, Vespasiano finds himself in the position of an old dog, and you know how that goes, chary of new tricks. So he packs up shop and he retires to the countryside, a little bit embittered, as I understand. Well, you know, Ross, this is really fascinating to me, because you had established earlier that there was this culture in Florence of what you call the democracy of knowledge. And then with the advent of the cheap book because of the printing press and the entrance of that era of the common reader, seems to me like the logical aims of a democracy of knowledge are being achieved, and he's resentful.
Yes, well, because he's a character who's full of contradictions, and I think, most of his clients are very affluent. Manuscripts have been found that people have written in the flyleaf that they've bought the book from him. People often wrote in their books where they bought it, and they never failed to mention him because of the fact that I think they knew that because he was the king of the world's booksellers, the resale value of their book would increase if it had sort of the imprint of Vespasiano on it. So ideally he would have wanted the spreading of knowledge, but in the end he was a snob, and he talked in the 1490s, towards the end of his life. He died in 1498 at the age of 76. He had quite a long life for someone in those days. But he became quite embittered, and he would speak about the masses in very derogatory terms, and the ignorant. So I think in the end, perhaps he showed his true colors, and he was always a part of a sort of an elite that was wary of this knowledge falling into the hands of the common people. Because that, of course, is one of the objections that people made, a lot of people made about the printing press, that there was a man in Venice who said that, you know, we should smash them all because of the fact that now ideas can be spread at the crossroads and in the piazzas, and the common people are going to be able to read, they're going to have knowledge for themselves. And this is something that, for the people in power, was somewhat disconcerting and frightening. And I think Vespasiano as well was somewhat alarmed by the prospect of this knowledge filtering down to a level of society which perhaps he felt it should not be filtering down to. It should just trickle down so far so that the certain people in society would have the wisdom to guide the people beneath them.
Is there, and this is just, there's no right or wrong here, but is there a counterpart today to someone like Vespasiano?
Good question. I suppose what he did was he took knowledge that already existed and he multiplied it and spread it as a kind of entrepreneur. In some ways, I mean, his world is so different from ours, it's very difficult to find a parallel today because the economies of scale are just so very different today. Everything is so much larger. But I suppose we might be able to think of, I'm not even sure who this would be, but someone who is maybe dedicated to producing, I suppose a lot of maybe smaller presses we could compare him to, who are devoted not so much for their own economic benefit, but producing beautiful artifacts, maybe something like the Folio Society in the UK, who produce beautiful versions of books. Because Vespasiano, I should say, never made a lot of money. He didn't become wealthy. And in fact, he was buried in his brother's tomb. He didn't even have his own tomb. It's very difficult to make, you know, over the course of 400 or 500 years, kind of comparison of a present day Vespasiano, but you know it's much more easy to maybe compare something like the printing press to the internet because they had a similar effect on society, and also the objections to the internet that we have today and that we've had for the last 30 years that some people have had for the last 30 years are really the objections that people had about the printing press, i.e. that it was going to be spreading stories that weren't true and that people were going to get access to information that was either incorrect or information that they shouldn't have, that they didn't deserve and they weren't worthy of. So it's easier to draw that sort of a parallel than one with someone who is producing manuscripts on parchment.
What a fascinating man this Vespasiano must have been. And you say, just the last thing I need to ask you is, in retirement, you say he produced remarkable books And our understanding of the Renaissance itself, in part, goes back through that portal of his understanding of what was going on in his day.
In some ways, that's the most important thing he did. If part of his legacy is creating all of these manuscripts and diffusing that knowledge really widely, sadly, many of those manuscripts have been lost. Probably at least one in two of all the manuscripts he created has been lost in fires at various places. However, the one thing that did survive of him is a book that he wrote, which he called Lives of Illustrious Men of the 15th Century, because he said, what I need to do is celebrate the great men of our time. He said there were great men in ancient Rome, and the ancient Romans celebrated them, so I'm going to be an historian of the 15th century and tell you about all the people I've known. And that's what he did, and it's an absolutely vital resource for historians, because it gives he gives biographies of Cosimo de' Medici, of Cosimo's sons, of King Ferdinand of Naples, all of these people that he dealt with, and also a number of his scribes. And so we get this great panorama of life in Italy. And he also writes about some of his English clients and his Hungarian clients, this great panorama of European life over the course of about five decades in the 1400s. And as I describe in the book, in some ways, the whole concept of the Renaissance that we have today and that we've had for the last, say, 150 years has come out of that, because a man who wrote a kind of classic work on the subject, a Swiss scholar named Jakob Burckhardt in the middle of the 19th century, found a copy of Vespasiano's work soon after it was published. Vespasiano was not published until the 1830s. It existed only in manuscripts to that point. And when Burckhardt found it, he was electrified by it and reading these stories. And it inspired him to write about the Renaissance in his book, The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, which there are online versions of it, but I think it's never been out of print in the last 150, 160 years since it came out. And it really gives us the outline of the Renaissance. And it was owing, as Burckhardt himself says, to Vespasiano and the stories that he tells and the arc of the acquisition of knowledge and the diffusion of knowledge that he describes in his Lives of Illustrious Men.
I said that was my last question, but I lied. I've got one more. The great sculptors, the painters, the architects that we associate with the Renaissance, are they indebted in any way to someone like Vespasiano, at least in part?
Yes. Vespasiano himself seems not to have had much of an appreciation of art. He does talk about, he talks about Brunelleschi and Donatello and the way they've done works that are there for all to see, but he doesn't really dwell on it. He really seems to have been a man of words rather than images, and he doesn't appear to have been especially interested in architecture beyond how it could be constructed to create a beautiful library. But obviously the artists were participating in the same world. Vespasiano was very close friends with Cosimo de' Medici, who was very close friends with Donatello and Michelozzo, the architect. And so there was all of this cross-fertilization. And in fact, one of the lectures that I sometimes give looks at exactly this kind of cross-fertilization and the way in which the what the Florentine scholars were looking for, the sort of heroism and virtue that they wanted to stiffen the sinews of the Florentines and the Italians, thanks to immersion in Roman culture, the culture of the past, the culture of Quintilian and Cicero. This then takes three-dimensional form in things like the statues of Donatello, the statue of St. George done for Orson Michele, for example. There's a great sort of back and forth between the literature and the artist, which then expands as the century goes on, and artists like Michelangelo get involved with the circle of Lorenzo de' Medici and the Neoplatonists, the people who've read Plato and are very interested in Platonic philosophy and Platonic theology. And Michelangelo is caught up in all of that, as is Sandro Botticelli. So there are very close links between and among them, not least because Florence just had, say, 40,000 people throughout much of the 1400s. So everyone knew everyone else. one of the things I describe in my book is the way in which someone who passed Vespasiano's bookshop every day on his way to visit his father was Leonardo da Vinci, whose father, Ser Piero da Vinci, had his shop two doors down from Vespasiano's. And in fact, Ser Piero da Vinci, who was a notary, was the notary for Vespasiano. Vespasiano used Leonardo's father for his legal documents. And also, as I reproduce in the book, an image, something that Leonardo has drawn when he's standing in the street, literally across from Vespasiano's shop. So there is this, there's no evidence that Vespasiano and Leonardo da Vinci ever had a conversation, but it's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility. So all of these, because of the small population, the small footprint of Florence inside its walls, all of these people were bound to know each other and were bound to come together in the street, in the piazza, and begin bouncing ideas off one another. And that's just one of the remarkable things about Florence that helped create this wonderful period that we call the Renaissance.
Ross King, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you, and thank you for your latest contribution, this new book. It's great to talk about it. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marcus.
Ross King with us, and his most recent book is titled The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. Want to hear a quick highlight from one of our favorite discoveries on Constant Wonder? This comes from a conversation about some wild and violent instances of crime behind the truffle trade. And in the middle of all that high drama, I got Ryan Jacobs to describe what real truffles taste like. Not the cheap ones, but the ones that are nearly priceless and pretty hard to find.
It's almost impossible to describe what it tastes like, but if you had to describe the taste, it tastes like mountain earth, like cold air, like something that you can't really put your finger on. Some people have compared the white truffle to sort of a kind of garlicky, umami kind of taste. But the closest thing analogy I can give is like, it's almost like, you know, taking a drug or something. The experience is really sort of intoxicating, and you get very easily wrapped up in it.
Ryan Jacobs is author of The Truffle Underground. Isn't that a great title for a book? The Truffle Underground, a tale of mystery, mayhem, and manipulation in the shadowy market of the world's most expensive fungus. If only people chose place names with the very same care given to baby names, we might not have such oddities as Atomic City, Idaho, or Coward, South Dakota. But there's always a reason for these names, you know. New York City has countless backstories for its place names. Harlem, Arthur Kill, Gramercy Park. And there's a bright fellow who has bundled together great stories about all of this in his new volume. It's titled Names of New York, and we're going to have a chance to meet him this Monday right here on the show. Hope you can join with us then. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.